Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you at least three different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Our first topic today combines Ohio State University, a mysterious radio signal, and a new sci-fi series from Netflix. If that sounds like I just rattled off three unrelated things, then you're going to want to hear what Jeff Spry has to say. He's a contributing writer for Space.com, and he's written about a new show, Three Body Problem, and what's known as the WOW signal. Welcome to All Sides, Jeff.
Thank you very much. This is the first time I've been live on radio, so I'm honored. Thank you so much.
Oh, that's great. So let's start with a scene from episode 2 of this new series where the WOW signal gets brought up. What is the WOW signal?
So the WOW signal was, at the time, back in 1977, it was one of the most promising candidates for a signal from a transmission, possibly from an alien civilization. And it occurred on August 15th, 1977. It was a warm summer night at the Big Ear radio telescope at Ohio State University. Now, that telescope has since been sadly torn down. In 1998, it was torn apart to make way for, I think, condos and a golf course, as these things go. And at the time, the radio telescope was not being manned. It was a summer night. And at 11:16 p.m., the computers recorded a 72-second signal. And that signal at the time was rather intense. And it was 26 seconds of a rising intensity and 26 seconds of a falling intensity, which represented the Earth as it turned away from the origin point of the transmission. A few days later, Dr. Jerry Amon, who was a professor at OSU and a volunteer for this program, he went over the printouts that were brought over to his house every few days, and he saw all of a sudden this string of numbers that corresponded to the intensity of the signal. And he circled it and wrote, "Wow." And the letters and numbers were 6EQUJ5. Now that represents it was a alphanumeric system that they set up showing the intensity of the signal, 1 to 9, and then intensities of 10 or more indicated by a letter starting with A. And so at the time, that was a pretty shocking revelation for him, and he circled it, shared it with his friends. The signal was never repeated ever again, yet 47 years later, it still stands as one of the great mysteries in astrophysics at the time and still today. And it's used as a plot device in the new Netflix series, Three Body Problem. And that's where you came in with episode 2.
Yeah. So we're going to play a clip from that episode. So to set the scene, there's a London detective that shares some information he's uncovered with the head of a clandestine organization.
Back in 1977, Ohio State University detected a 72-second sequence. They called it the WOW signal because it made all the astrophysicists go, "Wow." They said it looked like an attempt at communication.
Attempt from who?
Little green men.
What's it say?
No one knows. No one's been able to decode it, and nobody outside of Ohio State detected it.
And in the show, they deviate from reality by inserting that China has picked up another signal. And then they are off to the races with their sci-fi series.
Right. And so in the series, which I rewatched that episode last night again, in the series, there is a secret radio telescope in Inner Mongolia that one of the main characters, who's an astrophysicist, is manning at the time. And in 1977, it takes 8 years for this alien race to get the signal that she transmitted back 8 years before. And she translates it, and the translation is, "Do not contact us. I'm a passive observer, and if you respond, we will come and we'll conquer your Earth. Well, the main character, spoilers here, the main character decides to respond because she's sort of fed up with the world and just wants sort of a clean start. And so she responds
Agent
to
of Chaos there.
Yeah, that sets forth a 450-year journey that this alien race is coming, but it's going to take him a while to get here. And so what's interesting is when I saw it last night again, they actually used the real numbers alphanumeric system on the printout sheet that she gets. That's how great the show is from the producers of, and creators of Game of Thrones, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. And so I thought that was a great detail that they actually used that alphanumeric sequence when she pulls off the printer and she looks at it. It's the exact same alphanumeric code that Dr. Amon saw it back in 1977 for authenticity's sake. And so, right, that's the only in the fictional world of the show. That's the only other place that picked it up that was looking at that place in the universe, which was near right off of the constellation Sagittarius, some 1800 light years away.
So how significant would it be in the scientific community if it had been replicated then, or if it started reappearing now with any kind of consistency?
Extremely. If it had been repeated and confirmed through multiple locations, it's sort of like, if you watch the 1997 movie Contact with Jodie Foster, that's a perfect example. She's sitting there with her headphones on, listening, and all of a sudden a signal comes in that is not from any satellite and it's not from Earth. And in it, it's repeated. And that's what they're trying to get in it. The sequence starts in the movie and then it abruptly stops. And then they're all, you know, heartfallen. And then it repeats itself. Then they start getting online with other places on the Earth, because obviously as the Earth turns, it's not going to be pointed in that same place anymore. So they start getting all the other radio telescopes in other parts of the Earth to pinpoint that spot. And in the movie, in Contact, yes, they authenticate it. And it's, you know, later they decipher it. But it would be monumental, because after you eliminate that it's space debris or something from Earth or a comet or something. Once you eliminate all those things. And in that movie, she does the same thing. They sort of look and find there's a pulsar here that it might've been. And it's some other neutron star that it might've been that's already been cataloged. But so if it was authenticated, it would be monumental. It would be huge, and we wouldn't know about it. we're too panicky of a race to be able to handle it. You know, we can't handle even small things. So something like this would be shocking, and that's what the show is about. You know, obviously the alien race that is coming makes some overtures to prove that they really are real, and those things, I won't spoil them because they're pretty shocking and interesting in the show. But yes, if it was ever replicated, it would be incredible. The problem is that, I mean, there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy alone, and there's hundreds of billions of galaxies out there. I mean, our minds are just not capable of wrapping themselves around the distances of space. And so even in that pinpoint location that they were looking at, there's actually 66 other sun-like stars that might have exoplanets around them. But they've tried 50, 60, 70 times of doing deep sky surveys of that same area. Never, ever once in 47 years have they had that repeated ever again.
One of our producers actually got astronomer Jerry Ammon on the phone, and he described to her what happened when he came across that transmission.
As I was looking through the printout, I saw the sequence 60QUJ5 on channel 2. There were a total of 50 channels. And doing much thinking, I wrote the word "wow!" exclamation point in red ink in the margin of the printout. And then I completed looking through the entire printout to see if that signal repeated on the following days, and it didn't.
And it's undecipherable. Like, the show gets that correct. But people have been trying for the last couple decades to try and decipher what it says. We just haven't figured it out yet.
Well, at this point, the frequency, it was at 1420 megahertz, which is the frequency of hydrogen, which is that hydrogen emits. And that's the most abundant element in the universe. So that's why they were looking at that frequency in that spot. And so it's not that there was any kind of message done. The six EQUJ5 is simply, that is just simply saying how strong the signal was as the Earth passed through it. And so it really wasn't any kind of message at all. However, in the show, it is a message, and that she does decipher it and then responds to it, unfortunately.
And Jerry, he still ponders the meaning of that signal.
Well, the meaning of it...
I wondered what it might have been, but since I can't answer that question definitively, you know, I don't know what the source was. Of course, one thinks of the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence sending a signal like we on Earth have sent signals, you know, from radio telescopes or from satellites and so forth.
And I think that's what gets captured in this imagination, in this three-body problem, because we've been sending music, clips of speeches, all kinds of information just out into the universe for a long time, waiting to see if anybody answers.
Right. And that's where the whole idea, I got to interview Neil deGrasse Tyson on his new book a few months ago, and we were talking about the theory of the dark universe, and that people are asking, well, or the dark forest, it's also called. It's the idea of, well, if there's this many planets and galaxies out there, it's the answer to the Fermi paradox of, well, where is everybody? And the answer is they're hiding, because any advanced civilization that reveals themselves of where they are stands the chance of being invaded and conquered. And so you're not sure of what this other race's intentions are. And so everyone's just kind of hiding out. That's one possible theory that I happen to believe in, but me just being a journalist and not an astrophysicist or a scientist in any way. But it's always fun to think about, right? I mean, everyone loves a great mystery. And what better mystery than are we alone? Is there anyone out there, right? Everyone, that's one of the great questions that will hopefully be answered at some point, maybe in my, not necessarily in my lifetime, but at some point, I assume that it will, because I do believe that there is life elsewhere in the universe.
Final question. Three-body problem it's a strange name for a show, but it actually refers to a term in physics. Can you just quickly explain in layman's terms?
Yeah, it's pretty easy, even for my extreme right-brain thinking. A three-body problem is simply the celestial or orbital mechanics involved in three actual bodies, astral bodies. So think of the sun, the earth, and the moon. That's also a three-body problem. In this fictional world of the books, the trilogy of books that were written that was adapted into the TV show, this planet called Trisolaris, that the Santee live on. They call them the Santee in the show. They're not called the Santee in the books. They're just called the Trisolarans. So on this planet Trisolaris, unfortunately, it orbits three suns. And whether or not those suns are aligned and eclipsed, or whether they are spread out every few centuries or millennia, their planet either burns up or freezes, they have gravitational anomalies, so they have to constantly be rebuilding their society because of the unpredictability of those three suns. and an object that's caught in the gravitational net of those three suns as they go about their orbits and movements. And so that planet is inhabitable. And so they've been looking for a better planet that has a little bit more stable sun. And here that becomes ours. So yeah, it's just it's a complex formula people have been trying to figure out. In this show, they never figure it out. They try to figure it out. They try to help them to figure it out so that they can predict these moments of calamity, but they can't. And so that's the three-body problem.
And that was Jeff Spry, a contributing writer for Space.com. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
I was honored to be your first radio interview.
I hope I did well. Thank you.
It was great. Coming up, what new research tells us about boring buildings. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you at least three different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. For our second topic, I want to imagine that you're giving someone a tour of the buildings in downtown Columbus. What comes to mind is a must-see? The State House? Maybe the old dispatch building with its giant sign on top? The Hayden Building, Leveque Tower? What about the architecture in German Village? Our next guest says there's a reason we think of those buildings, why we choose them over the seemingly identical towering glass boxes that populate the rest of downtown. And the reason could impact more than your itinerary. The building can impact our environment and even our moods. Joining us to explain is architect Maria Krzysztofska. Her work focuses on neuroarchitecture and the human behavior in the built environment. She's also a postdoctoral researcher at Tufts University. Welcome to All Sides, Maria.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Thank you for having me. I'm truly honored to be included in such an important discussion.
So, critics call the increased amount of boring building designs a bland-demic. Can you kind of explain what that means?
Yeah, so the impact of the built environment on human conscious and unconscious reaction has been a long-standing theme among neuroscientists, psychologists, and sociologists for decades. It's fascinating how architects and urban designers have historically either overlooked or under-utilizing the potential of new technologies to develop more sustainable design. Recent research projects have attempted to bridge this gap by identifying and quantifying spatial features of urban environments through computational means. While these efforts have led the groundwork for advancing new methods of urban analysis, there remains a challenge in integrating these findings effectively into design practices. We used to design based on what we like instead of what actually affect people and their conscious and unconscious reactions and response to the built environment. And that is a crucial problem now, because designing cities ignoring the necessity of biophilic characteristics, for example, and the more adherence to assumptions of sustainability by designers has resulted in cities devoid of character, incapable of intriguing their inhabitants, and incapable of creating special evocative memories. This is a huge problem. This approach has led to the creation of unwelcoming environments that are easily forgettable, let's say. So people are not willing to walk on those cities.
And if a building is forgettable, if it's not like the Leveque Tower or something that we think of as iconic to our specific city, like the Empire State Building, the Sears Tower, all these kinds of famous places, what I found fascinating in researching for this episode is that when we don't feel a connection to it, the buildings don't stick around for very long. They get torn down sometimes in 30 or 40 years. And that causes a significant amount of building waste. Like a lot of those torn down buildings end up in our landfills, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, the last 6 years, researching the impact of the new buildings, let's say, if we can explain it easily to our listeners. Consequently, people that cannot connected or create memories on buildings, they stop thinking of them, they forgot it, they are not willing to involved in public or trying to navigate through those through the built environment. So that create the necessity of recreating those buildings to transform it or make it more compatible, let's say, with the era that we are passing through. This leads to buildings that are just standing up for 30 or 40 years. And that's causing a lot of construction waste. And also, it's really hard for people because the constant redefining of the built environment, it uses additional stress, diminishing the willingness to walk and engage with the public spaces and consequently with other people, and leading to an increase in health and psychological issues that we can see. Psychologists can ensure that psychological issues and problems are increased nowadays. And now we as architects and urban designers has a crucial role to play in the designing process and in the well-being of next generations.
So most people would assume that it costs more upfront to design and build complex buildings. And that perhaps this is just simply, it's cheaper to put up the square glass box of a tower than it is to give it a lot of design and flair. Is there truth to that?
I can ask from my experience the last 6 years as a neuroarchitect and also the last 13 years as architect and practitioner. This is not true. Actually, the cost that we have to face by building really fast glass boxes, let's say, is bigger than the cost of rethinking and redesigning buildings and cities with character, because people can easily engage with buildings in characters. We are running a research now in Tufts University about the texture, the color, and the symmetry, and the role of those characteristics in stress reduction and navigational processes. And we saw that glass and the synthesis of really of buildings without character cost stress increases, so people are not willing to walk, are not willing to commute. They are feeling that the we call it peripersonal space, the space of people that are we have a personal space that we don't want anybody to get in this area. And the personal space actually post COVID, its permeability decreased, causing less coexistence, especially in the public space. So we were building cities and environments that they are not helping people to interact. Then buildings will be destroyed in 30 years, causing a lot of sustainability issues and environmental problems. And people are going to stop interact. They will not understand the built environment around them. And also there is another higher risk of increasing diseases and disorders related to memory, because spatial memory is really crucial. Neuroscientists and psychologists can explain it better than me, but the ability to interact with the built environment, creating spatial memories and the ability to navigate is really crucial for future memory diseases like Alzheimer's.
You know, I think we all instinctively know that buildings can impact how we feel. Like anyone who's ever been inside a Gothic cathedral with those soaring arched ceilings has probably been humbled by it. Mm-hmm. And you know that feeling when you walk into one of those old cathedrals with the really high ceilings. Why do you think we forget about that impact? Like, if that can impact you, why do you think we somehow assume that, like, the standard issue office complex can't impact you?
We are living in an era full of images. So we learn how to process and absorb a lot of information really fast, but forget also those information really fast. Our research are focused in unconscious and conscious comparison of the responses of the users. What is really interesting to say is that most of the participants in our researchers cannot recall what they actually saw from the unconsciously. We are using eye trackings and other sensors to record the actual response to the environment, responses of the participants to the environment. We have the memory of our ancestors about the built environment, and that's why we are feeling those emotions if we enter in a church or if we saw a symmetrical building or a landmark, but we cannot recall it because we didn't learn how to recall the unconscious. And that's because of the era, because we passed through a lot of crises the last years, COVID, the Anthropocene crisis, a lot of migrations. So we forgot how to process the information that we are getting, and spatial characteristics, spatial stimuli, and spatial information is really hard to be recalled because we learn how to first focus on the so-called dangerous stimuli. For example, if we are walking in a city, we will not see the sidewalks or the horticultural elements if the street is from is full of cars and high-speed road, because we are instinctively trying to protect ourselves. We are processing really fast all the information. And we have, as designer, to rethink the way we are designing all the built environment to help people stop thinking this fast and processing all the information that fast. If we want them to recall all the information, remember all the information, and can conscious responses. Imagine that only 10% of people participating the last 6 years in all the researches can recall 10% of the information they are consciously observe consciously.
That's really fascinating. And can you tell us a little bit about the technology you're using to create these statistics? So you're essentially walking people through a cityscape and monitoring where their eyes look?
Yeah, actually, we are doing both. We are checking in laboratories with eye tracking and skin sensors, and also I try to make people walk by using the.
Well, that was Maria Cristofi, an architect and postdoctoral researcher at Tufts University. And I want to thank her for taking some time to talk about how buildings impact our environment and how they impact us as people. Coming up, we're going to be talking about smart kitchens and whether we really want computers in our ovens. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Smart kitchens and smart appliances are everywhere. But as our ovens increasingly become computers that can bake a cake, we wanted to know whether that's something consumers really want. Here to help us is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. So, welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
It seems like there's a bit of a mismatch between what designers are designing and what consumers are buying when it comes to smart kitchen technology.
That is painfully true. There has been an effort for really almost a decade now to make everything in your kitchen smart. And some of them have been wildly unsuccessful, whereas some of them have only been kind of sort of unsuccessful. My personal favorite is I have a friend who lovingly sends me a picture at least once a week of the small camera inside of his refrigerator that takes a picture of the contents of the fridge and labels all of the different things. And those labels are almost always every single time wrong. It cannot correctly identify a gallon of milk to let you know that it has run out, which is one of its primary functions. But it can tell you that that jar of marmalade looks an awful lot like relish, which it absolutely is not. And so it's funny, every once in a while, you know, someone asks for kind of a smart thing that goes into their kitchen. And a lot of them are really bad, but not all of them.
Yeah. And so we kind of want to talk about a few specifics. But first, I want to talk about what makes a kitchen device smart, because there's Wi-Fi enabled, AI powered. So what are we talking about when we define something as a smart appliance?
So for us, the threshold for something being considered smart is that it has a connection to the internet and receives instructions from an alternate source. This can be a software update that happens from the manufacturer. It can be an app that lives on your phone. But, you know, it is connected to the internet in order to help you in some way. Whether it's actually doing the helping or not is a whole different question.
Yeah, so let's start with there's a lot of mixers and blenders and processors, but GE has a smart stand mixer with a built-in scale, which is kind of neat, so you don't have to like weigh your ingredients before you dump them in. But then it's supposed to detect the consistency of dough and change speeds and adjust. And as a baker, that just gives me pause, because like I like to go by feel and by sight.
Yeah, so this is definitely the kind of thing that I would not recommend to a ton of people. But yeah, the goal here, on the one hand, seems quite useful. If I pour in a cup of flour and it turns out that the scale built into the mixer says, actually, that measuring cup is slightly off, you might want to add a little more. As someone who is terrified of baking and lets my daughter do all of that because she is just immeasurably better than I am at exactly this thing, That I can see that being quite useful to someone like me. Having it stir around and, you know, kind of measure the friction of that stirring, you know, based on, you know, kind of a set of pre-programmed things for what cake batter should be or what bread should be. I can see that being useful to some folks, but there are a lot of people like you, Anna, who very much bake by feel. And if they look at it and go, yeah, that looks quite, you know, then that's kind of all you need. So it really just kind of depends on who you are. But this is definitely not something that I would recommend to someone who has a ton of experience in the kitchen and just knows based on years of experience what is and isn't right for them.
I also kind of wonder if you run into the refrigerator problem that your friend talks about, where it mistakes, you know, relish for mustard and all these like different funny, like, I just wonder if the mixer could go wrong too, if the tech isn't quite right and it starts like, you know, mixing cake batter like pancakes.
Yeah, all of this is based on a pre-assumed knowledge that you and the whoever programmed this thing have the exact same definition for, are using the same kind of flour, using the same kind of butter, you know. There is often, every once in a while, you see kind of a viral thing show up on Instagram or Facebook or something where butter from Costco weighs more than normal butter, that the sticks are not exactly the same. It turns out this has been debunked in several different ways, but it's a thing that comes back every once in a while. So you think about stuff like that when kind of identifying what has been programmed in this. Does the person who, you know, is responsible for the programming in this believe in that particular conspiracy theory? That kind of thing is unclear.
Yeah. And so there's also things like smart meat thermometers, which I'm trying to, like, why does my meat thermometer need to talk to the internet?
So this one I actually personally use. And the reason that it's useful is if I have something out on the grill that I know is going to be cooking for a significant period of time, and I know that lifting the lid is going to cause all the heat to leave the grill, then I can have that thing in there and I can leave it somewhere where its goal is to just get warm, and it notifies me on my phone or on my watch when it has reached that correct internal temperature. So I can stop the other thing that I was doing and go and, you know, kind of check on that thing. You can also do this for stuff in the oven, but I find it particularly useful for when I'm doing grill stuff.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. There's also a smart oven from Brava, and it uses infrared heat to cook different foods at different temperatures in the same oven. That's wild.
Yeah, so a lot of smart ovens are kind of a trap. And the reason that a lot of them are kind of a trap is they are designed, a lot of them, not all of them, are designed to sell you on a subscription for the stuff that that company makes. So I think Tovala is one where, you know, you can buy pre-made kits of food from them and you scan a little barcode on the top of the package and the oven has all of the instructions it needs to perfectly cook that thing, which is great, but it only works for the stuff you buy from them. So it doesn't, you know, there's like some preset ingredients for a couple of other things, but it is not kind of a universal thing, which is what Brava is actually trying to accomplish by having you put in, you know, this is a 10-ounce filet and, you know, a 600-gram cup full of carrots, and have it put in and you know, use infrared to cook them separately.
That's really fascinating because, like, that's always the debate if you're really into cooking or baking. Do I need the double oven so I can do different things in different ovens for big events? And it sounds like Brava is trying to do it all in a single oven.
Yeah, there's been a couple of different attempts now to have smart oven, you know, tech where it can kind of correctly identify the stuff that's in there and make things a little smarter. And in some ways, these are kind of getting smarter and doing better. But unfortunately, the state of the market means that a lot of the ones that are available right now are just kind of trying to sell you a subscription.
There's a smart composter, which, okay, what is going on with the composter?
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of these out right now. For composting, and they're a little on the clever side. A lot of them are actually sold to you as put your food in here, and in a day, in like a couple hours, you've got dirt that you can use and take outside and do stuff. And they actually don't mention the word composting almost anywhere in their marketing materials. The language around composting, I don't know if it's just something that certain people avoid, or, you know, kind of what the reason for that is. But there are a ton of these, and they're actually incredibly useful. The one that we've tested that we like the most is called Mill Bin, and the goal is dead simple. It is a sealed container, so none of the, you know, kind of odors get out. You put your food scraps in there, you hit the button, and in like less than an hour, in some cases, you've actually got soil that you can take outside and, you know, kind of do what you want with.
That's a little bit like magic.
It does feel a little bit like magic, and Like the smart ovens, there are a couple of these that exist out there that are really heavily subscription based, because the like containers that everything gets put in are kind of one use, and so the goal is almost like coffee pods to get you to, you know, kind of only buy from them.
That seems antithetical to composting.
That is exactly correct, which is why the word composting doesn't get used a whole lot in some of these marketing materials.
Oh my goodness. So I have to ask, since we're talking about all this smart technology and it all connects to the internet, big picture, are they sending things back to these companies? Are the companies learning things about us the more we use these devices?
Always an important question. The cool thing about having all of these different apps is that even when that potential exists, users have the ability to not send that information. When you first install an app, it says, hey, these are the bits of information that they're asking for. Do you want all that information? And you can select no for all of the different things that that they're asking for. We've not really come across a ton of experiences where, you know, like the closest thing you get to data being harvested in a lot of these are recipes being used. And a lot of that doesn't come from harvesting that data so much as users being able to submit reviews for those recipes, or, you know, kind of leave notes and things like that. So, you know, kind of heavily active things end up doing the other thing and sending that information. One honest to goodness benefit to all the things that are web connected. Very recently, I realized that nothing in my kitchen needed to be reset for daylight savings. That it had all kind of automatically moved. And the only thing that I needed to switch was a clock that I had in my living room. But yeah, so like there are some, you know, kind of tiny benefits to some of these things. But, you know, I don't love the idea of an oven needing a software update, especially if I've got, you know, kind of a big cooking event coming up. So it's really kind of a minefield right now, and picking the right one can be a little tricky.
I also think the bottom line is, if you don't like to cook, a smart kitchen isn't going to convert you.
It's not going to convert you. And I think, you know, especially for right this second, if you don't love cooking, there are so many better options that we have right now is in like pre-delivered meal kits that keep you from ordering fast food that just make a lot more sense for folks in that, you know, kind of particular persuasion.
Let's talk about Garmin and their watches, because anybody who does any kind of exercise, this is a debate, right? Garmin, Apple, all the other watches out there. So I want to talk about the Forerunner 165 series. How it's a more budget-friendly option, right? How does it stack up to its more expensive brothers and sisters?
Yeah, so Garmin's got a whole bunch of different smartwatches out there, and unfortunately, it is not nearly as good as some of the other companies at naming them, so you kind of get a word and some numbers, and you're left to kind of figure out what's going on here. This one in particular that we just tested is called the Forerunner 165 Music. Which is, you know, a thing that everyone will remember immediately after this conversation for sure. And its big thing is that its base price is $300. Garmin watches tend to be a little more expensive. They tend to not necessarily compete with Apple watches for a couple of different reasons. One is they tend to have considerably longer battery life, and they're just tracking a lot more in terms of your health and your activity and giving you a lot more information. They are really designed for people who are much more fitness focused and want a, you know, control over as much, you know, kind of personal health data as possible. And Garmin's big approach with this system is to give you all of that health tracking information for only $300 instead of the standard $500 for the more expensive version of this watch, while also giving you music controls so that you don't have to have your phone like mounted on a bike or attached to your sleeve or something like that.
So is the watch compatible with all different kinds of smartphones? Because I know we've talked sometimes that, like, you know, Apple tech doesn't play well with non-Apple tech.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the really fascinating conversations when it comes to the Apple lawsuit that we were talking about last week, in that, yes, you compare a Garmin watch to an iPhone and it will deliver a fair bit of information, but it is never going to be as functional as an Apple Watch. Apple has created features that only work if you have an Apple Watch when it comes to things like using Apple Wallet or, you know, kind of wirelessly sending things from one watch to another. So what you do get if you have a Garmin watch paired to your iPhone is you get to control things with the Apple Music app. You do get notifications from the iPhone, but they're a little clumsy. You don't get to respond in the same way that you would with an Apple Watch. And things like texting, you know, via Apple Message isn't available, but you have like quick responses that you can get to within your watch. So you do have some connectivity, you do have some features, but it is, if you are used to an Apple Watch, you will notice that there are just some features that aren't there. And that is by design.
So this is the entry level watch, essentially, for Garmin. And there's a big price jump, you know, $300 to $500. That's a pretty hefty price jump. How do you decide whether you want the 165 or the more expensive 265?
Yeah. So what this ultimately comes down to is the kind of workouts that you're doing. If you are just running or just cycling, there's a pretty reasonable chance that the 165 Music is all you need to get started and kind of, you know, have a nice watch that does really great fitness tracking that you aren't going to have to charge every single night before you go to bed. What you are going to notice if you are used to Garmin watches is the waterproofing isn't quite as good. So if you are a diver, even at, you know, kind of shallow, you know, 10 feet or more, this is probably not a watch that you want to wear. If you do really long, you know, kind of swimming sessions, this is probably not the one for you. And it's not quite as impact resistant as some of its competitors. So if you do things like, you know, freeform mountain climbing or something like that, you may find that this is going to get scratched up a little earlier than its more expensive counterparts.
So let's talk about TikTok. The U.S. government is trying to force ByteDance, the parent company that owns TikTok, to sell because it doesn't like that the company is Chinese-owned. There are concerns about Americans' data privacy and concerns about what the algorithm is teaching them about all of us. So you and I have talked about this before, but what we haven't talked about is Steve Mnuchin. And I have to say that Trump's former Treasury Secretary stepping forward to buy TikTok was not on my 2024 bingo card.
I have to say that I agree. The number of things that Steve Mnuchin is connected to, especially when it comes to like entertainment and things like that, always kind of surprises me when a new one pops up. He's got a fairly diverse portfolio in that way. The ownership of TikTok is still kind of an open question, but what we did get from Steve Mnuchin this week is his plan for what would happen if he was able to successfully buy TikTok. And it's a curious one. A big part of what makes TikTok both exciting and mysterious to the point of worrying to the United States as kind of a whole is its algorithm. You know, the For You page on TikTok, nobody really understands how it works. You get things that are delivered to you and it turns out that there are things that you're really into, but you're not really sure how TikTok knew to deliver those things to you. And that algorithm is locked down tight. It's something that is proprietary information and TikTok does not share in any way how it functions. So Steve Mnuchin's plan would be to acquire TikTok, all of TikTok except for that algorithm.
Which seems isn't that like a key component of having TikTok?
That is certainly a key component of having TikTok as it functions right now. If your goal would be to replace that TikTok algorithm with something that you had paid someone to build that can deliver information that is limited to what you think is useful or what you think is you know, kind of safe and important. If you had a particular set of values and you felt like those values should be the defaults as a social media company goes, then that might be a pretty reasonable reason to you know, kind of describe this in this way, is because you have decided that what would make U.S. regulators okay with TikTok existing is if you know, what you considered to be the standard for American values was what was presented to that audience.
It's kind of like they're carving the heart out of TikTok and then trying to replace it with another one.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth pointing out that one of the reasons that TikTok is as popular as it is because the current crop of social media services don't have an algorithm that works quite as well. And in fact, in many cases, the algorithm that exists for things like Facebook and Instagram are actively alienating to the audiences that move to TikTok for that reason. So, you know, the algorithm being replaced would have to be something that was different enough than what was currently available, but still useful to the existing audience to keep people on the platform. Otherwise, everyone will leave.
So China has made it pretty clear that they're not letting go of the algorithm. How likely do you think it is that they'll sell it without the algorithm?
It seems incredibly unlikely that you know, this is going to result in a sale to Steve Mnuchin. This plan really seems more like a way to, you know, kind of garner support and you know, kind of continue that conversation about what can and can't be available on our phones as American consumers. And there's also, you know, kind of a bulk conversation that needs to be had about the security implications that have been made. You know, United States citizens still don't really know what it is that's so scary about TikTok, because all of those conversations have been had in you know, kind of private briefings and behind security clearances. So it's tough to really identify whether this would be successful if ByteDance allowed it.
That was Russell Holly, the managing editor for commerce at CNET. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.